Chris Gibson, what's the Blue Water Navy bill?
Well, look, this is a bill to ensure that veterans who served in Vietnam, who were part of our Navy that was offshore in Vietnam, if they were exposed to Agent Orange, that they're going to get the medical treatment that they need. See, what we have done is, we have defined those that are eligible for health benefits attendant to Agent Orange exposure to those who served on the ground in Vietnam, boots on the ground, as it's often called, in the Riverine Navy, those that moved up and down the rivers. So what that's missing, though, is the fact that when we use this defoliant, in the way the prevailing winds ensued, that it impacted those that were serving off the shore. So myself and others in the Congress are of the mind, this is a bipartisan bill, that we need to bring a simple definition forward that ensures that those who were serving offshore that were exposed to Agent Orange get the medical attention that they need.
Let's move on to North Korea. You're a military guy. You've had this background. What do you make of it?
Well, look, I mean, it's certainly a very curious situation. I mean, it's a very close state. Carefully guarding what kind of information that they put out. There's no question here that there's an inner circle. And, you know, we have a situation where the ruler passes on, the powers of the executive move to the son. But this is a larger organization that's running the country. And from our standpoint, I mean, look, we're working with friends there. And also regional actors, particularly China, so that as North Korea moves forward, that they do so in a peaceful manner and in a manner that's in the best interest of their people.
Now, what if, let's play war games, Colonel, what if the North Koreans wanting to bolster their guy do what they have done before and do something that's provocative? The one thing I have tremendous admiration for you about is your insistence that we think twice before we go anywhere and we start committing troops.
Right.
And I guess I want to know, since we do have obviously tremendous treaty relationships with the South Koreans, what we do if something like that happens.
Well, look, now is the time to work with the regional players, including China. Any kind of instability in that region is not in their interest. And if there is a country that can have influence on North Korea, it's China.
Are you convinced they can?
I am. Okay. I am. And I know that this is on the forefront of the priorities for the administration. And in this period of transition, that we're constantly looking for ways to strengthen the opportunities for peace and economic development in North Korea.
So if they do something really bad, they come over the line, after all, we're still at war with them, and they don't think of what's in their best interest in terms of China, then what do we do?
Well, I don't think that you go there. I mean, that's part of the situation. That is to say, you don't go to that hypothetical. Let me be more specific.
Okay.
Because what you're doing is you're moving in my view, on a plane that's unstable. And so what you do is you constantly work towards a reality that strengthens peace and stability. And the minute that you start talking about hypotheticals like this in a closed country such as North Korea, I think that you run the risk of actually a self-fulfilling prophecy. Take a look at, for example, what happened in history. There are those that point to what happened in 1950 as an example of a self-fulfilling prophecy. We had a Secretary of State at the time gave a major set of remarks, and he talked about the sphere of influence of the United States, and he left Korea out of his remarks. And some people think that it was read that way in North Korea such that they had an opportunity to conduct a military incursion without any kind of reciprocity or some kind of military response from the United States. So to me, I mean, among the things that I learned from that is you're engaged diplomatically, you're doing so multilaterally, and you're constantly reinforcing the goal that's in everyone's best interest, that a peaceful resolution to disputes that move towards economic development of North Korea is the only acceptable scenario.
So let me try one more time. Military tactician that you are, and we know that you are, and you've studied all of this, you know very well that in the Pentagon right now, somebody is playing the game you don't want to go to. Somebody is saying, if they do this, then we do this. So you know, you're a guy who believes in transparency and government and the rest of it. Isn't it in the interest of the American people that we at least think about this?
Well, what I think's in our best interest is that we have a military capability that has you mentioned transparency, that it is ever clear to the leadership, and I use the word plural, in North Korea, that it would be clearly not in their best interest to conduct any kind of military incursion. So while you have that deterrence, which is patently clear and which needs no clarification because it's already evident that all your diplomatic work is working towards what you view as the only acceptable state, which is a peaceful resolution to disputes and towards the economic development of the country of North Korea.
Chris Gibson, we have just a few more minutes, but as long as we're on this, it's the end of the Iraq War. You're on the subcommittee on readiness of the Committee on Armed Services. What in fact, is to be learned from what happened in Iraq?
Well, first of all, let me say that, you know, I think the president made the right decision here. I think that we have developed the institutions in Iraq, both the security institutions and the political institutions, to such a degree that they have the capability to defend themselves, to provide for stability. There are still going to be issues in Iraq going forward, but ultimately, I think it'll be relatively stable and relatively friendly to our interests. And that's not to say that there won't be moments, spasms of violence. I believe that will also be the case. It'll be very much inextricably tied to the maneuvering, the political maneuvering inside of Iraq. But to me, having served there and having returned there as a member of Congress and listened very carefully to what was communicated and viewed this in many different directions, that our continued presence there would have been a crutch to the key decisions that need to be made inside Iraq. Look, we're still going to be involved from an embassy standpoint in the way that we are throughout the world with our diplomacy. I believe we've earned a certain degree of respect inside Iraq. And I say that with all ethnicities. We've earned that through our previous experiences. And so we have some access and some influence that comes from that. So I want to state that up front. Well, what can we learn from this? Well, you know, you go back and take a look at Gordon and Traynor's book, The General's War. This was published shortly after the Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War. And if you look at the last chapter, Gordon and Traynor lay this out in detail as to why President Bush Sr. did not go all the way to Baghdad. Essentially, you get this strategic interplay that some argued would give another regional actor with a symmetry of influence and power. So, I mean, look, we're in a situation where nearly a decade later, we have reached a point where there's a level of stability and capability in Iraq that we can then reposition our troops, having accomplished our objectives. But I would hope that going forward, that whenever we have a solemn decision on the use of force, that we're carefully considering absolutely first-order effects, no question on that, and this is what the wargaming you mentioned earlier, but also the second and third-order effects of any kind of action.
Chris Gibson, always wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you, Al.